new presenter is Edwin Cook. He is a pastor in Gulf States Conference right now, and next month he's planning to graduate with the MA in religion from Southern. His hope is to get into a PhD program. That's what he's working on in religious liberty. So he will speak to us about the Lord of the Sabbath.
Well, it's my privilege to be here this afternoon with all of you eminent theologians. As Dr. Cluzet mentioned, in December I will be graduating, planning on graduating with my MA from Southern. So obviously I would say that I probably don't have quite the breadth of knowledge that a lot of the men in here do. And so what I've done, I've taken the approach of addressing some of these Sabbath issues and covenant and so forth that Dale Ratzliff has raised, more from a pastoral perspective, and have designed it, I've put it together on PowerPoint. And the key one passage that I've chosen to address is dealing with the Lord of the Sabbath. And that's found in Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 through 8, if you'd like to look in your Bible, or you can follow along on the screen. In that passage, Jesus said, "At that time, Jesus went on the Sabbath day through the corn, and his disciples were in hunger and began to pluck the ears of corn and to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto him, Behold, thy disciples do that which is not lawful to do upon the Sabbath day. But he said unto them, Have ye not read what David did when he was in hunger, and they that were with him, how they entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them which were with him, but only for the priests? Or have ye not read in the law how that on the Sabbath days the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? But I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple. But if ye had known what this meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, ye would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day." Parallel passages are Mark chapter 2, verses 23 through 28, and Luke chapter 6, verses 1 through 5. I've chosen Matthew 12, verses 1 through 8, because it's the passage that contains the most information of the three synoptic gospels on the subject. And just briefly, to give you a kind of an overview briefly of what Dale Ratzliff, what he's claiming in his book, and how he builds up to his argument about this passage in particular. In chapter 2 of his book, just a quick summary, he says the seventh day in Genesis 2, 1 through 3 refers to rest as defined by fellowship with God and not specifically the observance of the Sabbath as recorded in Exodus. So he's giving more of a spiritual meaning to the Sabbath there. He bases that on the fact that, as he's observed in the text, the first 6 days of creation have an evening and a morning. The seventh day, that phrase is lacking. Now, I believe that in his dealing with that passage in that chapter, he's overlooked the fact of the Hebrew term, yom, which actually, as another several Adventist scholars have addressed that issue, they have realized and determined that whenever that term is used, it actually has the significance of a 24 literal time period. Chapter 3, he claims that the Abrahamic covenant only included God's promise to establish Abraham and his descendants in the promised land. It was based solely on faith, he claims that from Genesis 15, symbolized by the rite of circumcision, and did not include the Ten Commandments. In chapter 4 of his book, he says the Old Covenant was specifically intended for the Israelite nation and included the Ten Commandments and ceremonial laws. Its three aspects were deliverance of Israel from Egypt, the ratification of the covenant at Sinai, and the settlement of Israel in the Promised Land. Chapter 5, he titles it Shadows of Christ, and in that chapter he describes the relationship between the Sabbath and other ceremonial laws, actually trying to blur the distinction between the Sabbath as a moral law and the other ceremonial laws that God had given that involved sacrifices. In chapter 6, he says the new covenant is Christ himself. It primarily focuses on the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. All Old Testament ceremonial laws, including the Sabbath, find fulfillment in him. In chapter 7, he entitled Jesus and Ritual Law, he claims that Christ was antagonistic toward ritual law and purposely subverted it. He claims that's why Christ had conflict with the Pharisees. Since the Sabbath was ritual law, from his perspective, Christ sought to abolish it through his ministry. In chapter 8, entitled Jesus and Old Covenant Moral Laws, he attempts to describe how Jesus had authority to change or modify Old Testament moral laws. In chapter 9, he addresses the Jubilee Sabbath and seeks to describe how Jesus fulfilled the Jubilee Sabbath of the Old Testament by ushering in the Messianic Age. And he bases a lot of his theology for that on Luke chapter 4. Chapter 10, entitled Lord of the Sabbath, he claims to show how Jesus exercised authority to change Sabbath laws, both ritual and moral, in other words, meaning the fourth commandment. Now, what I have done, what you see highlighted here in yellow, chapter 7, 8, and 10, those are the three chapters based on his claims that we'll briefly be looking at and addressing some of his hermeneutic and the conclusions that he draws, as well as comparing what he has presented in those chapters with what the Bible actually contains. Interestingly enough, just before we go into those, a review of those chapters and biblical texts, the one thing that I noticed predominantly in the book that Dale Ratzlaff had made, and again, this is not an ad hominem argument, I'm not attacking the man himself, but when you read through the book, you recognize that he has a flawed hermeneutic, and I believe you'll notice that as we go through and look at some of his claims and comparing those with scripture passages. Regarding chapter 7 of his book, Jesus and Ritual Law, Ratzlaff contends that Jesus was antagonistic toward ritual law and sought to subvert it. He gives two examples from the Gospels to support this claim. The healing of the leper, and that's found in Matthew chapter 8, verses 2 through 4, Mark chapter 1, verses 40 through 45, and Luke chapter 5, verses 12 through 16. Interestingly enough, as he addresses this topic, he does not focus on the remaining, the last two verses in Luke chapter 5, verses 15 and 16. And as he builds his argument, the reason that he does not do this is that he claims that as it's recorded there in Mark chapter 1, verses 40 through 45, Jesus touched the leper for the simple fact that Christ was trying to subvert Old Testament ceremonial laws, which basically stated that the individual who was clean was not to touch someone who was unclean, like a leper or a dead person or a dead man's bones. So based on Ratzlaff's contention, he says that Jesus touched the leper for the sake of trying to make the statement that he was subverting and overturning and actually changing, abrogating Old Testament ceremonial law. The second argument or example that he uses is the raising of Jairus' daughter from the dead, and those are the passages in Matthew chapter 9, verses 18 through 26, Mark chapter 5, verses 21 through 43, and Luke chapter 8, verses 40 through 56. Now, interestingly, when one goes and actually compares and looks back with what compares this passage, this incident of the healing of the leper, with Old Testament ceremonial laws, it is correct to state that ceremonial defilement occurred by touching a leper, touching a dead body, etc. And that's found in Leviticus chapter 13, verses 45 and 46, and also Numbers chapter 19, verses 13 through 16. However, the point that Ratzlaff does not mention in that chapter is point number two on the screen, which was ceremonial cleansing that occurred by sprinkling from water mixed with the ashes of a red heifer and applied by hyssop. It was performed by a clean person. That's found in Numbers chapter 19, verses 17 through 19. Now, I believe that he has neglected to mention this point because when we take that point into consideration, it actually leads us to understand that Jesus touched the leper not to do away with ceremonial law, not to basically show that it had no significance, but actually Jesus touched the leper to indicate or foreshadow that he is the source of cleansing. He fulfilled the role of the clean person and was symbolized by the red heifer through his sacrifice at Calvary. Jesus was trying to intimate to the people of his day, to the Jewish community, that he was the individual that was actually going to fulfill, not demolish or destroy or present in a negative light the Old Testament ceremonial laws. Thus, Jesus fulfilled Old Testament ceremonial law rather than considering it as something of insignificance. The raising of Jairus' daughter from the dead, I've mentioned the verses before. Just doing a quick comparison, we find that Elisha and the young boy who died in 2 Kings chapter 4, verses 32 through 37, Elisha actually touched this young boy and raised him back to life. He laid his body on top of him. And the Bible does not record any instance there where Elisha had to go and perform this rite of cleansing. In addition, in Matthew chapter 11, verses 2 through 6, when John the Baptist's disciples came to Jesus and were asking him, John wants to know, he's in prison, he wants to know, are you the Messiah that was to come? And Jesus referred in verses 5 and 6 of Matthew 11 the specific signs that were expected of the Messiah. And he mentioned the cleansing of the leper, the raising of the dead, the opening of the blind, their eyes so that they could see. So So the actual significance of Christ touching the leper and raising also Jairus' daughter from the dead was to fulfill the fact that his ministry included the roles of priest and prophet. As priest, he was not antagonistic toward ritual law. Rather, he came to fulfill it. Now, the reason that I'm helping us to recognize the distinction between what Ratzlaff presents in his book and what the Bible actually contains is that based on this perspective, it's going to lead to a better understanding of Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 through 8, where Christ makes the statement that he's the Lord of the Sabbath in Matthew 12, verse 8. Now, one other point that I think is also significant, and Ratzlaff did not mention this, he overlooked it completely, the significance of this fact that Christ is fulfilling the role of priest based on what he did in the healing of the leper and the raising of Jairus' daughter. The weekly Sabbath burnt offering, as recorded in Numbers 28, verses 9 and 10, and also Leviticus 23, 38, was distinguished from other ritual offerings. Now, this is significant for the fact that based on Christ fulfilling Old Testament ceremonial law, he would not be able to fulfill the offering of the Sabbath that was offered on the Sabbath that was distinguished from the other ceremonial laws until after his resurrection. Because it was after his resurrection, he ascended to heaven, and in the first compartment of the heavenly sanctuary, that is where, based on these passages in the Old Testament in Numbers 28, verses 9 and 10, that the priest performed this work of offering the Sabbath sacrifice. The Sabbath burnt offering was distinguished from the daily offering that was offered morning and evening. It was also distinguished from any time the Passover feast landed on the Sabbath day. It was also distinguished from the Passover offering that was offered. So basically, because God himself distinguished the Sabbath burnt offering from all of the other ceremonial offerings, Christ would not be able to fulfill that portion of Old Testament ceremonial law until he had gone up into the heavenly sanctuary in heaven in the first compartment of that sanctuary. That would be after the fact that he'd been crucified and resurrected. Based on that, we also recognize then that the Sabbath has some element of a continued significance after Christ's death, burial, and resurrection. Regarding Jesus and Old Testament moral law, Ratzlaff claims, and this is chapter 8 of his book, he claims that Christ exercised authority to modify moral laws of the Old Testament, changing them from legal stipulations to moral principles. Now, the significance of that we need to bear in mind is that if that were true, that means that Jesus would take something like the moral Sabbath and he could actually abrogate it and establish something else in its place, more of a spiritual Sabbath. And that's what Ratzlaff is arguing. The examples that he uses are Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 through 44. And in that passage, you see it there on the screen, Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill. But I say unto you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment." In the same chapter, in verse 28, Jesus uses that same type of paradigm statement where he refers, "You have heard in time of old, it was said, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, if a man looks lustfully upon a woman, he's committed adultery with her in his heart." In verse 32, he applies the same paradigm regarding divorce. And in verse 34, the same paradigm is found regarding oaths. Now, based on this, again, Ratzlaff contends that Jesus actually came to change legal stipulations to moral principles. However, the other point that Ratzlaff concludes then is that based on this claim, Ratzlaff asserts that Jesus also had in mind to modify Sabbath observance to the principle of spiritual rest found in him. And he ties this back into the Genesis account where he contends that that's a spiritual rest and not actually something that God intended for people to observe. This claim that he's made in that chapter 8 of his book, though, it overlooks point number A, no principle can negate the law from which it is derived. And that's a philosophical argument. He overlooks that point. For example, based on what Jesus said there in Matthew chapter 5, 28 about getting angry with your brother, can I kill a man as long as I am not angry when I do it? Obviously not. So this is a point that Ratzlaff has overlooked that is a very fundamental philosophical argument that basically it undermines the whole point that he's contending for. And point number B, I found that through my study that Ratzlaff actually had a flawed hermeneutic regarding this point. In Matthew chapter 19, verses 1 through 8, Jesus states that divorce was allowed through Moses because of Israel's hardness of heart. But, and this is the important point that Christ makes, it was not so from the beginning. Thus, Jesus implied that moral law, and this is one of the key points, it preceded the Sinai covenant.
We had a somewhat of an emergency where we had to get a person out of here to a doctor. And the license number 0417G at Grand Marquis is blocking the car that we need to move. And one of them has that car, Grand Marquis 0417G. Move it.
Coming back to point number B then, the flawed hermeneutic that I found in what Rasleff was contending is that Christ's own teaching actually contradicts the claim that he's contending in chapter 8 of his book regarding Jesus and Old Testament moral law. We find a clear example in Matthew 19 verses 1 through 8 that Jesus was making the statement that actually God's original intention that existed way back from in the Garden of Eden before sin entered the world is something that Moses was allowed to modify because of the hardness of Israel's heart. So based on this, we recognize the fact that Old Testament moral law under the Sinaitic covenant actually had a point of beginning before the time of Moses. Now, coming to this passage about the Lord of the Sabbath, Rasleff argues that Christ considered Sabbath regulations as trivial, thus indicating that the Sabbath was ritual and not moral in nature. Now, actually looking at the passage itself in Mark chapter 2, 27 and 28, that is related to the passage in Matthew 12, verses 1 through 8, Jesus said to them, "The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore, the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath." That's in Mark 2, 27 and 28. Based on this, Jesus directly links the Sabbath with creation and emphasizes its universality by using the terms for man and Son of Man. Now, the significant point here is that if he is the Savior for all of humanity, then the Sabbath is intended for all of humanity. And that's the point that Christ, one of the points that he's arguing there. So based on the previous passage in Matthew 19, verses 1 through 8, and this passage in Mark 2, 27 and 28, we actually find two examples in the Bible where Jesus himself predates moral law found in the Ten Commandments before the time of Moses. Now, the other point that we find, and I thought I'd touch on this briefly, regarding the passage under question now, we're specifically focusing on that, regarding the Lord of the Sabbath in Matthew 12, verses 1 through 8. In Luke chapter 6, verse 1, the Bible actually adds an additional element that's found in the Greek to these other two passages of Mark 2, 23 and Matthew 12, verse 1. In Matthew 12, verse 1 and Mark 2, 23, the Bible simply says that Jesus went on the Sabbath day through the corn. Now, if you go back and look in the Greek New Testament, you'll find that in both of those passages, the term Sabbath is used in the plural. And in both Matthew and Mark, the Greek is plural, sabbathin, indicating the possibility of this occurring during the Passover when there was more than one Sabbath that they were to observe. Luke chapter 6, verse 1, a parallel passage, seems to confirm this view since it reads as follows. "And it came to pass on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the cornfields and his disciples plucked the ears of corn." The Greek text, en sabbato, deuteroproto, literally on the second first Sabbath, meaning the second Sabbath of the first week of the three Sabbaths marked at the beginning of the Passover. Now, interestingly, when you go back and look at the Nestle Allen Greek New Testament in the 27th edition, if you look under this passage in Luke chapter 6, verse 1, you'll find that in the textual apparatus, it is indicating that this phrase, en sabbato deuteroproto, they do not list that as what they consider to be the accepted Greek text on this passage of Luke chapter 6, verse 1. If you read it in the Greek that they accept as the canon, you'll find that it's not included. They have relegated this portion, en sabbato deuteroproto, to a class C in the textual apparatus. This basically means that in their understanding, they believe that not enough New Testament manuscripts would support its inclusion in what could be considered as the New Testament canon. Now, I personally contend with that conclusion that they've arrived at simply for the fact that if it were included in the original canon in what we would consider the accepted text, it does not detract from the meaning of the passage. Actually, it enhances it. Now, the reason I would say that is that the two previous passages, Luke chapter 12, verse 1, and Mark chapter 2, verse 23, it actually is using Sabbath in the plural, indicating that it would allow room for this meaning that's found in Luke chapter 6, verse 1, which refers to the Sabbath as the en sabbato deuteroproto, meaning the second Sabbath after the first. Now, again, the reason why I'm including this is that it also seems to harmonize with the Gospel of John. If you go and look in John chapter 1, verse 29, John made the statement, "Behold, the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world." That is one of John's proclamation statements that carries a theme all the way through chapter 11, dealing with the Passover feast and how Christ would be the Passover lamb that was sacrificed at Calvary. Paul makes the same contention in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 7, when he says that Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed for us. So based on the Gospel of John, it would also give weight to including this phrase, en sabbato deuteroproto, in Luke chapter 6, verse 1. Now, what is the significance of that? This view about including that phrase in Luke chapter 6, verse 1, is held by Lightfoot, Scaliger, Edersheim in Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, and also Jameson Fawcett Brown, their critical commentary of the Old and New Testament. Ratzlaff dismisses Luke 6, 1 through 5 as inconsequential. He says that in that passage, it has nothing else to add to the understanding of the Lord of the Sabbath. Before we look at the main arguments that Christ gives in Matthew 12, verses 1 through 8, concluding on this point about including en sabbato deuteroproto in Luke chapter 6, verse 1, the reason that I would feel that it's something that's important to recognize is that at the time that this argument that we're about to look at the time that this argument occurred, it was actually during the second Passover of Christ's ministry. And for that reason, it was during the time Luke was recognizing the fact that this first Sabbath included actually three Sabbaths. Two of them were ceremonial and one was the moral Sabbath. In particular, in Matthew chapter 12, verse 1, when this argument, this dialogue occurred between Jesus and the Pharisees, it was actually on the moral Sabbath, on the seventh day Sabbath. The importance of recognizing both Christ doing this and having this dialogue during this time is it's regarding the ceremonial fulfillment of the Sabbath laws and also Christ recognizing the fact that he was speaking as the authority of the Sabbath, as Lord of the Sabbath. The main arguments that Christ gave regarding the innocency of his disciples in plucking the corn, he argues regarding David and the showbread, which is found in 1 Samuel 21, verses 1 through 6. The priestly duties in the temple, such as preparing sacrifices and arranging the showbread each Sabbath, Leviticus 24, 5 through 9, and Numbers chapter 28, verses 1 through 10. And the third argument that Christ gives, he quotes from Hosea 6, chapter 6, verse 6, that he desired that they would show mercy rather than focusing upon ritual or sacrificial law. Now, putting these three arguments of Christ together, he concludes by saying in verse 6, Matthew 12, verse 6, "But I say unto you, something greater than the temple is here." He's referring to himself as the one that was not only the priest who would fulfill ceremonial Sabbath laws, but also upholding the validity of the moral Sabbath. And he was the one who was greater than the temple itself. One of the challenges that the Jews had during the time of Christ is that they ended up spending a lot of time on ritual. There was a very good article put out by the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society, November 2003. And in that passage, in the whole article, there's an individual non-Adventist where he's arguing that Jesus actually was not refuting and arguing against the halakha, the Jewish legal interpretation of the Torah, the Old Testament, in places where he felt, where Jesus felt that they had misinterpreted Old Testament moral law, Jesus was correcting them, like found in Matthew chapter 15, verses 1 through 9, where the Jews said that Korban allowed a person to come out from under the obligation of the fifth commandment to honor their parents. But in other places, Jesus was actually in harmony with the interpretations that they gave. So based on this, what Christ was contending in this passage, this dialogue of Matthew 12, verses 1 through 8, he was trying to correct the Jews in their the rigidity that they had applied to the Sabbath, and he was trying to help them understand that the original intent and meaning of the Sabbath was not something that was to be a rigid exaction of laws, for man, but instead the Sabbath was made for man. It was a blessing for man. And that's why he ends up saying in Matthew 12, verse 8, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. If you compare that with Mark chapter 2, verses 27 and 28, he links the fact that he's the Lord of the Sabbath by also mentioning that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Conclusions that we can draw then from this very quick and brief overview. Christ did respect halakha, the Jewish legal interpretation of moral law, as long as it was in harmony with the original intent of moral law as God gave it. His contention was directed toward the hypocrisy of the Jewish leaders, not so much against ritual law and tradition. This is significant to establish this point because, again, that's what Rashleff argues and contends for, is that Jesus was arguing and fighting against the ritual law as a means of abolishing even the Sabbath ceremonial laws as well as Sabbath moral laws. Point number two, Christ fulfilled ritual law that pointed toward him as the Messiah. Point number three, the Sabbath incident referred to in Matthew 12, verses 1 through 8 and other passages very likely occurred during Passover and in the midst of ceremonial Sabbaths. Point number four, Christ amplified moral laws and did not modify or change them. Moral principles are rooted in law. Point number five, Christ's teachings show that some moral laws, such as the sanctity of marriage, predated the Sinaitic covenant. In light of this, and based on Mark 2:27, Jesus implies that the Sabbath commandment also predated the Sinaitic covenant. Since Christ came to amplify moral law, point number six, and not abrogate it, he teaches that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Works of mercy and necessity are wholly proper in keeping with Sabbath observance. And that was the point that Christ was trying to correct in the understanding of the Jewish leaders. Have a blessed Sabbath.
We'll take a couple of minutes if there's somebody with a question. Steve?
I think it could also strengthen me to
speak up.
In Matthew 8, when Jesus healed the leper, and in verse 4, he tells the man, go show yourself to the priest in obedience to the command of Moses, directly antagonist.
Yep. Very good point.
What was that?
Matthew 8, verse 4. Jesus commanded the man to go back to the priest and show yourself to them in fulfillment of Mosaic law.
Well, that does not seem to show disrespect to Moses.
Correct.
Any other questions? Yeah, Clint?
No, in fact, actually, from the studies that I did on the topic, I believe I mentioned this when I was touching on that point, that the dialogue actually did occur on the seventh-day Sabbath when they were going through the grain field. When one goes back and looks in the Jewish writings regarding moral law and ceremonial law, they did allow an individual to do such actions when it was one of the ceremonial Sabbaths, go through the grain field and pluck. But on the moral Sabbath, they prohibited that. And that was one of the things they were complaining about regarding Christ's disciples doing that. The only reason that I emphasize the fact that that dialogue in Matthew 12, 1 through 8 occurred in the midst of ceremonial Sabbaths during the time of the Passover is to emphasize the fact that Christ was fulfilling, in one sense, ceremonial Sabbaths, and in the other sense, he was actually showing his authority for a seventh-day Sabbath moral law. The significance of that is that as high priest, he also would continue to fulfill the role of the ceremonial Sabbath, of the Sabbath offering that was offered on the seventh day Sabbath in his high priestly ministry by offering him his own self before the Father on the seventh day Sabbath of each week. So it shows the perpetuity of this and the significance of the seventh day Sabbath after his death, burial, and resurrection.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.